The BOAG World Show is back for a season about how you can build a more user-centric culture at your organisation. We begin our journey by talking to Martin Redding about the culture at Virgin Atlantic. This episode of the BOAG World Show is brought to you by Tikkara and Balsamic. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and we're back. And Marcus is back with me.
Yeah, woo. Yeah. Still feeling a little bit relaxed after my lovely holiday.
Did you have a lovely one? Where did you go?
I went to the Caribbean, to the Dominican Republic.
Yeah.
Yes. It was very nice.
How long's that? That's quite a long flight, isn't it, to the Dominican Republic?
It was about 9 hours on the way out and a bit longer than 8 on the way back. But yeah, it was fine.
I disapprove. You see, what you need to understand, Marcus, is now I am single-handedly saving the planet.
Because, I've been gathering that from your comments.
Yes.
Like, yeah, I have. No one cares.
I have an electric car.
So do you?
Yeah. So this is the new latest purchase I've made. We've purchased an electric car. So therefore, I'm suddenly incredibly opinionated about ecological issues, and like to bring it up at every opportunity to talk about how terrible other people are to the planet in a smug and self-satisfying way.
Tell me it's a Tesla.
No, I can't afford a bloody Tesla. What do you think? I made a money. I'm redoing our house. They cost a fortune. No, it's a Nissan Leaf.
The new one?
Yeah.
It's nice. Oh, they look lovely.
I've got to say, it is absolutely brilliant. It's like driving a bumper car because you only have one pedal, you see. You put your foot to accelerate. When you take it off, it stops. It's like idiot-proof. So
yeah,
perfect for me.
Does worry me a bit though, that one pedal thing.
Oh, you can turn it off.
Right. So you kind of have to, you can do like an emergency stop if you want to.
Oh yeah. Well, you could turn it off entirely if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But also you regularly still have to put your foot on the brake because, you know, you get maybe a bit enthusiastic. And so, yeah, it's not like you never use the brake. It's just,
I see. I just imagine there was one pedal, which would scare me a bit.
No. So, yeah, anyway, that's what's been happening in my world. And we're almost
back. Far more importantly, I have to comment to you on how gorgeous you're looking in all of your shots now, Paul.
Well, yes.
Was there any Photoshop in there?
I'm told no.
Oh, right.
I had to get some photographs done.
You look like a film star.
I think the lighting was very well done. Let's put it like that. So, yeah, it was horrible getting it done, but it desperately needed doing. I'm always getting asked for photos of me for, like, speaking and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so I finally bit the bullet and thought, I'll do it. But, yeah, that's an experience I never want to repeat.
Weird. I did loads of it, obviously, when I was younger. I'd hate to have to do it again.
Oh, just, yeah. Anyway, so there's that. So let's tell people about this season of the podcast. We have to stay a bit more on schedule this season because most of the episodes are made up of interviews. Mm-hmm. We've got a whole load of interviews coming up over the season. So essentially what the season is about building a user-centric culture in your organization and all the challenges and stuff that goes around doing that. And we've got an amazing lineup of guests that are going to be on the season. And so what I've essentially tried to do is create the biggest cross section of companies I could think of, and look at their culture within their organization and how user centric it is or how unuser centric it is. It's a real mix. So we've got. Today we've got Matt Redding,
Martin
from Virgin Atlantic, which is, you know, Virgin Atlantic is obviously known as a very kind of customer friendly and customer centric company. Next week we've got somebody from the University of Dundee, talk about totally different. The week after, somebody from Cisco. And then somebody from IBM, who are at very different places on their journey, even though they're in a very similar sector. Mm-hmm. We've got people from somebody from Uber coming on. Then we've got somebody from a sex toy manufacturing company.
Who's been on the show before.
Has been on the show too. But an amazingly interesting story to tell about, you know, the challenges around customer experience. That's one of my favorite interviews that's coming up, actually. And then we've got people from agencies and insurance companies and all kinds of stuff. So it's a really interesting season where you get insights into what's going on in all of these companies. So I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a good one.
Well, I've listened to a couple so far, and yes, they are both top.
I know,
very
right?
Interesting.
Good. So, but we're going to do something else this season. Mm. I've been thinking long and hard about this, Marcus. Right?
Yes.
How many? I mean, we've done what, 500 plus episodes? I would have thought by now we must be pushing that kind of number.
Yeah, there thereabouts. Yeah.
Yeah, and over all that time, you've basically done nothing.
That is not actually true, but yes, well, I'll go with that.
I'll give you the fact that you come up with a joke at the end of each episode. But, you know, you don't really provide any value.
Paul,
You've been dead weight for these 10 plus years.
I love you too.
So, dear listener, I'm encouraging Marcus to actually do some work this season. So we're going to introduce a new thing at the start of the show called A Thought for the Day from Marcus Lillington.
Mm.
And Marcus is going to share some profundity with us. And, you know, I think this is, I'm really excited about this because, you know, Marcus has this huge well of a decade's worth of experience and knowledge of working in the digital sector. He's, you know, and so I am utterly convinced that every syllable that comes out of his mouth is going to be life changing for people.
It'll be very similar, I expect, to the thought for the day on Radio 4 in the morning when the sort of the leaders of the, you know, various churches and religions around the world come on and say very wise words about how to live your life well, you know, fruitfully, that kind of thing. It'll be pretty much, maybe even a bit better than that.
I think it's going to be better. I think it's going to be a lot more relevant to our audience.
That's my biggest problem, keeping things relevant. But hey.
So I think
this week's is.
Oh, you've got one. You're ready. Oh, you're actually prepared. Do you know, it didn't even occur to me that you might actually have one ready for the first show.
Okay. I was thinking the other day, probably quite a few other days actually, that quite a lot of the time we struggle to get any kind of user input into the start of the projects we do. Now, obviously, you want as much input from users as you can get at the beginning, throughout a project. But we do a lot of work for kind of quite high-powered law firms, and they have various different audiences, some of which we can get to. But the most important ones, the people that sort of decide to hire these people, are not interested in the slightest in feeding back to, you know, some questions or an interview from me about how the website is. They are not interested. Mm. So what do you do, basically? This is the thrust of this post. What do you do if you can't get to any users? So I started to think about it, and I thought, well, one of the most common thing we do, even if we can get to sort of users, is, well, let's do a survey.
Mm-hmm.
And it's seen, I think, particularly by people within organizations, as surveys are seen as this kind of way of validating everything that comes afterwards. Well, well the survey said we should be doing this, so we're going to do that. But we've done loads of surveys over the years. I mean, I don't know if you remember, Paul, when we worked for MSF, we did about 20 surveys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
In all different languages as well. But, I mean, not singling them out, but my general feeling over the years is that surveys aren't that useful. I think you can get them wrong. Mm-hmm. You can ask far too many questions. You can ask too many open-ended questions that you can't really do anything with once you get the responses. But even if you do it right and you answer just maybe two questions and you can really do something with it, I still don't think that they're that useful.
Really?
Yeah.
What about for something like top task analysis?
I think I've done it, and I think that you can certainly input that data. I don't think you're getting necessarily bad data from something like top task analysis, but what you're getting is the people that respond to surveys generally are people that love you or hate you.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, and I'm just, I can only really go on my own feelings here, but I occasionally do respond to surveys, and it is either in that I absolutely love what you're doing and I want to tell you about it and tell you you're doing it brilliantly, or I'm going to have a right old moan. Otherwise, I'll just carry on. Mm. So I guess the point I'm making there is I think that though, and I've just said that I think the data you get is valid, I think it's skewed. And so therefore, you may create a skewed design from your skewed data.
I agree with that. I mean, but I think to some degree, it depends on the questions you ask. So something like in a top task analysis test, you're not asking what people think of anything. You're literally asking them why they were here. You know, what were they coming to do? What do they want to achieve? And so that's less likely to be skewed. But generally speaking, I absolutely agree. Yeah.
But you're still likely to get someone skip it if they're in the middle of your user, or the majority of your users are more likely to skip that answering the questions. But anyway, moving on. Other things that you can do. Obviously, we can look at analytics, and you can look at analytics without speaking to any user ever.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of good. And you can look at, you know, popular and unpopular pages, ones with high bounce rates, and et cetera, et cetera. And you can extrapolate kind of user behavior patterns from that data. That's a hard thing to do. And it's something that our colleague Chris Scott is very good at doing, basically creating ways of looking at analytics data to enable extrapolation of that data. But again, the problem with analytics is you're always looking at past stuff. So you can't ask a user what their ideal experience might be or how they feel about something. You can just look at the figures. So it's useful, but it's a kind of supporting mechanism. The other one is salespeople. So if you can't get to speak to actual end users, speak to people who speak to end users.
Like this one.
Yeah, and that can, it's not necessarily, you know, kind of full blown salesman in a suit. It might be someone on a help desk, live chat, that kind of thing. And their responses, I think, are really useful. And I think it's really important that you speak to people in those roles. My problem with that is they tend not to want to be spoken to. senior managers are always, you know, senior people within organizations are always delighted to sit down for an hour and talk to you about this, that, and the other. But salespeople tend to think it's a bit of a waste of their time. But try, I guess, is my message there. And finally, it's this idea of sort of trusting your gut, or trust your own skill and experience, and start to kind of build a prototype first that you can test. Obviously, then if you can't get anyone to test, then that's a different thing. But you can test something real, even with the people you're working with your stakeholders. So get in and build something quickly, so that there's something real that people can get their head around.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much my thought for the day.
I like that. And I certainly agree very much with that last one about, you know, sometimes just building something, you know, quick and dirty, and then putting it out there and seeing how people respond is by far the best way of getting, you know, an idea of whether it's working or not. Because then that almost solves what you were saying about the analytics of, well, it doesn't show you the future. Well, you shove analytics on your prototype and you get to see whether people are responding to your future possible approach.
Absolutely.
So, okay. Well, that's brilliant. Thank you very much for you did very well.
Tick.
Well done.
1 out of 10. How many?
Yes, 10.
Are we doing
10 in
so
this
1 out of 10.
There we go. Well, I'm presuming you're going to do this forever now. That's it. You've committed yourself.
I quite like it, but it's not easy coming up with things.
Welcome to my world for the past 5 years.
I had that all written, so it's like, yay.
If you want to see what Marcus has written, I've just created a short link for you, which is boag.world/userinput, all one word.
Super.
Okay, let's do our first interview, which is with Martin Redding, as I said at the top of the show.
Well, you actually said Matt, but he won't mind.
Oh, did I?
Yeah. But you can apologise now, because I noticed.
You can go in and add that in, you know, like a badly dubbed movie.
Yeah, Martin.
Yeah. Yeah, do it in your voice as well. That'd be really funny. Okay. So, Martin, that's terrible, isn't it? The first guest, and I've already screwed it up. So he works with Virgin Atlantic, and I really enjoyed this interview with him. But I'm going to make you wait just a little bit longer for that. But before we get that, I want to quickly tell you about our first sponsor of the day, which is Tikkara.
And never heard of them.
Well, just because you've never heard of them doesn't mean they're not good, Marcus.
It was an invitation to tell me more, Paul.
Oh, okay. Right. So they sell tickets, right? Well, they don't sell tickets. They enable you to sell tickets if you've got a WordPress site. Mm-hmm. So maybe you're doing an event or, a conference or anything like that. And you've got a WordPress site and you want to be able to sell tickets for the event, whatever the event is. Then you should definitely check out Tikkara. They've got 80,000 downloads, so they are a well-established, well-used plugin for WordPress. Incredibly highly recommended if you read the reviews and stuff that people have written. And it's got really great workflow that integrates into your existing content, and it's really straightforward to use and set up and all the rest of it, as you would expect. Customers can even do things like select specifically what seats they're going to have if you want to offer that functionality. Mm. And when it comes to actually people turning up at the event and you wanting to check them in, this ticketing system also comes in with check-in apps, for iOS, for Android and Chrome, so that you can actually check people in when they arrive. So you don't have to, pay the overheads with some of the, these other services that do all of that for you. You can just run it all on your own site. And you can even check people in without internet coverage, which is very useful as it's inevitably bad at events. So they support hundreds of payment gateways, 20 plus built-in payment gateways, including things like WooCommerce, which is really common on WordPress. But they've got loads of other stuff. Also, with WooCommerce as well, they have like this bridge that kind of communicates with the WooCommerce add-ons. But you can use any payment gateway you want, basically. They've got loads of them. So if you want to find out more about them, give them a try. Go along to boag.world/ticketer, which is T-I-C-K-E-R-A. There we go. Okay, so into the interview. Martin, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show. It's really good to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, it's really good. So, this is a part of a new season for us where we're looking at user experience and the building user experience culture within organizations. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of sat down and I was thinking about, different companies that are at different stages in that journey. And one company that leapt to mind was Virgin Atlantic, because you're known for providing a great user experience as an organization, or a customer experience, should I say. So I thought, let's get somebody from Virgin Atlantic on the show to have a chat about it. But before we jump into that, tell me a little bit about your role at Virgin Atlantic. What is it that you do? How long have you been in post, that kind of stuff, just to give people a bit of background.
Sure. Okay. So nominally, I'm the head of user experience and optimization. My role is a new role. So I've only been in this role. This role has only really existed since November 2017. So it's new for the organization. And what that means for me at the moment is I'm in the process of formally building a user experience team. So as you know, so user experience happens whether you're designing it or not, whether or not you're consciously doing it, it is happening. And so And so my role was created to kind of bring a focal point to all of that and to try and find a means by which we could string together all of the different elements to the digital experience. So at the moment, my role is very much about putting foundations in place. My mm-hmm. role is very much about the setting up and the introduction of how the team will work. There's an awful lot of kind of what people would describe as design ops at this point in time. So establishing the tool set, establishing the tool kit, establishing what the roles will be and how they will form and grow over time, how we'll connect into teams, all of those kinds of things. So at the moment, it's me putting sticks in the ground and measuring things up and standing back and looking at it and yeah. sort of deciding the shape of it. There's a lot to do and there's a lot of foundational building work to do. And then aside from that, because Virgin Atlantic is not a company that stands still, you know, it's a company that moves very, very quickly. So as much as maybe I would like them to sometimes, the company isn't going to sit here and stop doing anything until I've got all of the pieces in place. So, the great analogy for my role here is building a plane that's charging down the runway. So I'm trying to then work out a way of bringing value into current projects that are about to launch. Whilst at the same time building a team.
Wow. That sounds easy then. No trouble.
Right. Yeah. I've got a lot of gray hair as a result.
I bet you have. So, on the other hand, hard though that does sound. I mean, like I said at the beginning, Virgin Atlantic is kind of known for its great customer service. You know, typically airlines are crap, aren't they? Let's be honest. You know, we all love a good moan about, you know, airlines. And there's been very high profile examples of that.
Ooh,
you know,
don't draw me into that.
Yes. No, I won't.
But I'm aware of where people's perception of it sits in the world. And you know what? It's very, very easy for companies to say they put customers at the heart of things. It's very, very easy. And you'll hear that a lot, right? Customers are the center of what we do. And it's very important to us. And sure, that's fine. And that's really easy to say. But I genuinely, for all the companies that I've worked with and for, I've never experienced anything like Virgin Atlantic in terms of how high up the priority order and how much power and emphasis is given to customers. It's really unusual. And what I found and what I've seen lots of times in lots of different organizations is that you go in there and you'll find somewhere in some corner this really diligent, hardworking and often frustrated team of designers and researchers and content strategists and developers and product managers possibly. And they're all trying to, we've heard it before, right? Getting a seat at the table. They're trying to be heard and they're trying to be, to kick doors down and get into conversations. And it's sort of upside down here. And it took me a while to really get my head around it in that all the doors are open and Virgin Atlantic is sort of begging for more customer insight and more user-centered practices. But we just don't have enough people. We don't have the team in place. So it's kind of the other way around here. I don't think there's any conversation that I could imagine anywhere around this organization where if someone said, this creates a bad experience, the answer would ever be, we just need to do it anyway. I don't think that exists here, and I think it's really rare, which is what has really ultimately drawn me to this role.
I'm not surprised. And that's a dream job you've landed.
Well, it's treated me very well so far.
So where does that come from, do you think? I mean, admittedly, you haven't been in post that long, but, you know, that kind of culture, how did it originate in Virgin Atlantic and is it nurtured? Are you seeing ways that it's reinforced, if that makes sense?
So where does it come from? It comes right from the start, to be honest with you. It's right through our genes. It's in our history. It was how we were formed.
Right.
And it's, you know, you can trace back through kind of Branson's biographies and documentaries and all that kind of information about where the airline came from. And at the very, very start, the very first flight that this airline ever took, they poured so much into the experience of it, and they've just continued to do so. And I think I'll get in trouble for misquoting this, but there is a quote out there somewhere about how he kind of referred to the fact he's not in the airline business, he's in the entertainment business. And you know, there's this history and there's all these wonderful stories from the past that are kind of floating around inside the organization about how the cabin crew used to, before there were films and music and all the in-flight entertainment and stuff, they used to come around and hand out packs of cards, and they used to play I Spy with the kids and all those kind of things. And that's just been there right from the very, very start, from the free champagne and the celebrities all the way through to all of the kind of all the finite work that happens here every single day.
Yeah. I mean, is it built into like the metrics that the organization is measuring, or you know, or any policies or procedures, or is it kind of more organic than that?
No, it's very considered. It's very well structured. We have customer experience represented at an executive level. We have a customer experience exec who sits alongside the IT exec and the finance exec, and you know, is right up there in our leadership team. So it's a big part of what we do, and it's formalized. You know, we have metrics, we have customer satisfaction, and we have you know, all the ways that we could possibly try and measure it, we'll find a way to measure it.
So your new team, do you report into the customer experience part of the organization?
No, I'm very connected to it, though. So the digital team sits inside the commercial team because it's primarily focused on e-commerce, and that's where the digital side of things came from. But one of the, you know, like straight through the door, I kind of was able to identify where the key partnerships were going to be. So the brand team and the customer experience team are very, very important to me, and I do my best, though they might disagree, but I do my best to try and, you know, walk among them and spend as much time as I possibly can with them and see where I can help them and where they can help me and keep them as close as we possibly can. I think it's an integral part. I think this, regardless of structure and regardless of what an org chart looks like, I think customer experience, brand, user experience, they're all intertwined, and they shouldn't ever be kind of thought as of separate things, because I don't think they are.
Yeah, and that's so good to hear how you're breaking down those kind of departmental silos and working alongside other people in other parts of the organization, because in my experience, when you're trying to establish a very user-centric culture, that's absolutely critical, because the user experience isn't just kind of siloed in one part of the organization, is it? It really spans the whole thing.
No, and we differ from an organization like, let's say, like Netflix or Twitter or something, in that no matter what we do, no matter what happens, our experience is always going to be involving some degree of a physical experience.
Yeah.
Like there's no version of this where you don't get on a plane and go to an airport. They have to be. They have to be. And we recognize that kind of weaving of physical and digital. And, you know, particularly now as there's the democratization of computing marches on, and screens are so much more accessible, and people are walking onto planes with these, you know, wonderful devices of all different shapes and sizes. All of those things just sort of nicely blend into one another.
Yeah. Going off on a slight tangent from maybe the questions I originally had, does that create conflict ever? You know, because you've got a customer experience team that are saying, you know, we care about the customer experience from end to end, and you as a user experience person pretty much say the same thing these days. So, you know, is there a kind of ever any conflict in terms of who's responsible for what?
Well, I think that theoretically, yes, there could be in every instance like that. But I've been in enough organizations that are going through kind of digital revolutions or digital transformations or whatever you want to call it. And some people go into those kinds of situations with their fists up and they look for that conflict. And in some instances, you know, people hide themselves in a corner and act like a scruffy startup. And maybe those things are right in those instances. But from my perspective, I actually sort of prefer the kind of hand-holding, calming approach. And we're all ultimately moving towards the same aim. Frankly, at the moment, I've got so much to do that I can't afford to be trying to copy over what other people are doing. So it's really more about recognizing accountability and why that's different from responsibility. It's really also about saying, despite what my ambitions and desires may be, I don't have a team of 1,000 people, so I'm not going to be able to get to every single meeting, every single decision, review every single design, sit in every single research session, look at every single piece of copy. I'm not, and nor is my team. So it's about kind of really trying to think as a single unit, as an entire organization, and just say, you know, this is our area, here's where we can help. I'm not being a lot of use here, so I'll back off, you do this. And sort of take that kind of approach to it, really. I'm not really good at just sort of kind of coming in and just starting fights with people and disrupting. I don't think I'd make a very good startup CEO. I tend to just like to make friends with people.
Yeah. And to be honest, I think in a well-established organization like Virgin Atlantic, that's the way to go. That kind of confrontational banging heads approach. You know, unless you've got really high level support behind you to be disruptive, and unless you've got a big team and all of the rest of it, it's never going to work. And even in those scenarios, even if you do have those things, you can bring about big cultural change in the short term, but it kind of comes to back to bite you in the longer term because you've just alienated a lot of people.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. And to be honest with you, there's so many smart people here and they're moving so quickly that I think even if I did try and take that approach, they'd kick me out pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, it's because there's already a well-established culture of customer experience within the organization. I was quite surprised when I first reached out to you to hear that your role was a relatively new one. Mm-hmm. So, why do you think that is, or what do you think the need is for your role in preference to, you know, if so much of the organization is already focused on customer service, and, you know, what was there a weakness in that area when it came to online? Where does your role fit into it? Why is it only kind of now appearing, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. It's a good question. I don't know that I've fully got the answer to it. What I do know is that the team has been relatively small and has been focused almost entirely on the e-commerce, the transactional side of the experience, and doing an incredible job. You know, the people who are in the team who have been here for a while have been doing an amazing job, and I think that from what I can sort of glean from what happened before I arrived, there was a kind of recognition from within the exec level that digital was an area that we needed to think more expansively about and invest in more heavily. And so the reason my role was created was part of a scaling up program in this area. So over the course, like I said, over the course of this year, I'm hiring a number of roles. My intention is to build up an internal design team to bolster the internal content team that's here already and start to build in a research team and connect into the product managers in a new way. So my role is about building those teams and then running the teams and overseeing the quality of what's output and seeing where our gems and our stories lie within digital, because there's loads of really great stories of customer experience wins and design achievements and little flourishes that really make it up from a physical experience. And we don't have enough of those in digital, and we haven't and we haven't sort of kept the alignment between digital and physical. So my role is about recognizing that the gap has opened up a little, and to try and close that gap.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I absolutely get where you're coming from. I am sat here slightly gobsmacked, you know, to hear you say things like, well, the executive recognized that they were maybe being a bit too transactional and needed to focus more on the user experience. I mean, there will be a load of people listening to this that are just swearing now and going, I wish our executive got that. So let's make them feel just a little bit better. All right.
Okay.
Can you share with them any challenges that you feel you faced? You know, where has it been a bit frustrating so far? And please don't say, oh no, it's all been wonderful. Come up with something, lie if you need to, but make people feel a little bit better.
Yeah, there's lots of challenges.
You're really struggling, aren't you?
I'm trying to work out how to be kind, because I you know, people I work with will listen to this.
Well, you can always say to them you lied, can't you, afterwards? So sure. It's fine.
Okay, so there are lots of challenges. There are a lot of people in the organization who have been here a long time. And like I said, there's lots of very bright people who have come up with lots of great ideas. And so from my perspective, it's relatively easy as a newcomer to come in and look at the airline, the e-commerce experience, the app experience and whatever, and sort of say, oh, here's an idea, and here's an idea, and these are great ideas, and haven't I provided a lot of value? And you will very quickly find 20 people who've had that same idea many years ago and have tried it, launched it, and have since wound it down. Because that's, you know, that's a really big challenge, because there's so many people with so many ideas, and new ideas are so welcomed and championed around here. You know, it's part of the entrepreneurial foundations of the company. That you have to work really hard and you have to move really fast to be able to come up with anything that hasn't already been tried, tested, thought of, rejected at some point in the recent times. And also, the other thing that is a challenge is, at the moment, and I can say this because there's nothing anyone can do about it, is the location. Because we're an airline, we need to be near the airports. So sort of charming people out of Brighton or out of Shoreditch or, you know, out of the city is hard, because we, you know, you can't walk to a nice deli or a pub or anything. And you know, the offices here are beautiful. The VHQ for Virgin Atlantic is very beautiful, and they take very good care of us, and we have cafes or anything, but, you know, getting people here is tough. That is tough.
And you feel that that's important for you to be co-located for as a UX team?
As much as possible in these early stages, yes. I mean, we're happy to support people who work at home, and, you know, obviously being an airline and having lots of different partners that we work with, travel is a big part of it. So people inevitably are on the move. But in these early stages, when we're kind of trying to get in front of people and trying to be as present as possible and trying to integrate ourselves into their various projects, you know, just showing up is a big part of that's a really big part of it. And, you know, if there are teams that are kind of sitting over in another part of the building and they're working away really hard, my aim is for just my team to just pick up their laptops and just go be a part of that team, you know, just go and settle down with them and say, hi, you know, I'm here to help you. I'm here to do this with you. And not really worry about, I sit with my team, you sit with your team. And so
I'm grinning from ear to ear. That's just spot on. I love it. Go on. Sorry. Keep going. I interrupted you with my enthusiasm.
So, getting people who are comfortable sort of spending 9 to 5 all weekdays out in the middle of nowhere in West Sussex is that's tough. But hopefully we are kind of putting together a package and a team and a setup that I'll be able to draw people towards.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like such a fertile environment for a user experience person to work in that I'm sure you won't have too many problems when it comes to recruiting. But yeah. Going back to that other challenge, the one about that because of the entrepreneurial nature of the organization, there's all these ideas that are coming up and anything you suggested has probably been thought of before. And that's something that I've often encountered when I've gone into organizations, but probably in a slightly more negative way of, oh yeah, we tried that 5 years ago and it didn't work, you know, right. That kind of mentality. Is there a recognition within the organization that, you know, okay, it might not have worked 5 years ago, but the world is changing at such a rate that maybe those ideas will work now?
Oh yeah.
Or do you see a resistance there?
Oh yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's not a kind of lot of people moaning. That's not the case. It's more of whether or not someone has taken that idea and gone all the way through to the end of the practicalities and dropped it into a market test. And actually the customers weren't that interested and it actually cost us a lot of money and those kinds of things. So as an example, we talked recently about book clubs on planes and being able to take books on planes and having libraries for children and this whole idea of adding physical back into the experience and all these kinds of things. All really wonderful. We're all very excited. And then, you know, we found somebody who had been here a while and implemented something similar. And they came back saying, do you know what? People came on board with their own stuff. They had no expectation of this, weren't really interested.
Yeah.
And we added weight to the plane, which meant more fuel, which meant as a company, we were less sustainable.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? And yeah. those kinds of things that you think, okay, that's solid thinking and that's, you know, that's
yeah.
very reasonable. But what we do have here is we have this kind of, we use this kind of mechanic of yes, but, and yes, and. And this is something which was sort of brought in recently or brought back recently by Daniel Kersner, who works in our customer experience team. And he likes to do it with his team as an exercise continually of when someone suggests something, you know, that kind of default response of yes, but blah, 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 which kind of drains you, is actually training yourself to say yes and. So yeah, we can do that, and we could do it like this, and we could do it like that, and we could do this, and it becomes this kind of escalation point. So the idea, the kind of the little seed of creativity that was really great at the start, suddenly turns into something maybe completely different, but it starts from a great place, and it sounds like a small language change, but the difference can be huge. You know, you go from here's a tiny idea that I'm nurturing that's kind of I'm a bit embarrassed about to suddenly it's blown up into this something terribly exciting that no one had thought of before.
That is probably the best single little takeaway I've heard on this podcast for a long time. I love that idea of you know, turning it around and saying yes, but yes, and. It almost reminds me of one of those rules of improv comedy, isn't it? Where, you know, if somebody's asks you a question, you say yes to it because that takes the conversation on rather than saying no to it, which kind of closes down that avenue and you need to then start something new up.
I like it. And it's cultural as well here. It's ingrained and it comes from Branson. You know, it comes from he has this sort of reputation and this name of referring to himself or people referring to him as Dr. Yes, because he just loves to say yes to everything. And in the induction process, when you join Virgin Atlantic, which is very involved and, you know, it takes days of kind of getting you into the company culture. At the end of it, you kind of have these kind of little sound bites and videos of Richard and, you know, sometimes maybe he even shows up at them. And he likes to just sort of end the induction with, he just comes in and says, yes. Now, what was the question? You know, he just loves saying yes to everything. And it's just sort of here and dripping off the walls is this idea of taking one thing and then turning it into something else and then the next and then the next and the next.
See, that brilliantly comes on to the kind of next thing I was going to talk to you about, which is culture and establishing the right culture within an organization. Mm. It sounds like it sounds like that induction process is a pretty good starting point. And, you know, that right from the very outset of joining the company, they're establishing this entrepreneurial, user-centric culture. But is there other things that you've seen from a cultural point of view that kind of stands out to you from a user experience point of view?
No, I think
the trouble is you almost don't notice it, do you? Where it becomes business as usual, as far as you're concerned, I'm imagining.
I think it will do. I mean, I'm very attuned to it, and so as I arrived here in my first few days and weeks, I was looking for those keywords and those triggers. And you know, the induction process is all, and the way you're ingratiated into the company is all. It's all part of brand, and it's all part of customer experience, and it's all part of the amount of care and time and effort that we put into people. But in terms of user experience specifically, that's kind of really my job. And my job is going to be very focused on, as I said, recruiting. So I'm building the team. So all CVs come to me, please. But also is onboarding all of those people that come into the team and then bringing them up to speed with my ambitions and my direction that I want to take the user experience in. And so those kinds of things are going to be wrapped around a set of user experience principles, which are all drawn down from the brand values. It will be around a set of metrics, which we have as a digital team. It will be a case of everyone who comes into my team, I will put them into as many scrum teams as possible before they settle, so they can sample all the different areas. It will be all of those things, and it will be taking people in the design function and having them spend time with product managers and analysts and content team. It will be as much mixing as possible and as much sharing as possible, because I don't think any of the UX work has been done out in the open. And from a cultural perspective, that's my biggest thing here. And it's in my last role as well, it was one of the biggest things that I kind of kept as my sort of means and drivers, because it can be a very insular craft. You know, it can be people at home, headphones on, creating beautiful things. And it's not always in our industry's nature to be overt about what we're doing. So as an example, we launched a project just shortly after I started, which was based around redesigning the digital help and how we help people in a digital part of experience. So sort of breaking this notion of FAQs, which I hate, and turning it into something that's actually valuable to customers.
Yeah.
And I formed the team, and we product managers and designers and researchers, and I sat them in the middle of the office. They didn't come and sit at the desks. They were sat in the middle, right in the center where everyone works. And everything that they produced at the end of each week, we put it on boards everywhere, just everywhere. So this sort of practice of churning designs out and post-it notes and research just became normal for people, because they just saw it every day, and it was, you know, it's tough for them because that team was sitting right where the kitchens were and all the phone calls were, and there was a lot of footfall, so it was like kind of being in Piccadilly Circus for them, but very important, because it just became so much more visible and just getting it out there and putting things up in reception and throwing things on workplace and the intranet and just telling everybody continually. It sounds like it's self-promotion, but it's actually deeper than that. It's about culturally exposing what we're doing. And the more you do that, the more people feel comfortable about it. And then the less those kind of things around people being threatened and worried about their responsibility goes away, because they just see it happening and they become accustomed to it, I think.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I mean, you talked about setting metrics as part of the cultural change. Now, you know, as somebody that's within the commercial department, you know, your traditional metrics will all be around sales and conversion and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. How do you intend to start encouraging more user-centric metrics? What kind of things do you think you're going to be measuring?
Well, so we have customer satisfaction metrics. I mean, via native apps, you know, there's no shortage of people who are going to go on there and give you a review of what they think about your app. We have a lot of open channels like live chat, which connects into our call centers, which are in this building. So we have these sort of various routes by which customers can get to us and give us that feedback, and then routes by which we proactively will go to customers after a booking or after a flight, and even during flights, and just pulse check. But I think the thing that's very important for me, and the thing that was a big draw for this role, is that I'm the head of user experience and optimization. And you know, in other organizations I see, and in other organizations I've been in, there's a divide opening up, and I find it really troubling between the people who are creating, designing, researching, and writing the experience, and this subset of people who are not connected to that, who believe their role is to optimize that experience, which in actual fact mostly just seems to be kind of fairly black hat, dark, aggressive kind of sales chasing short-term designs. And I find that really troubling, because I think they're the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't think that they're separate. And I think having metrics that you feel are, I think a sales metric is a customer experience metric. I think people are intelligent enough to look at an experience and say, this is horrible. I don't feel good about this. I'm not going to buy this. You know, in the airline world, there is a lot of choice. They don't have to fly with us. We don't have monopolies over things, so they can go to someone else, but they have chosen to come to us. And I think that is a user experience metric. And I think that the, not just the conversion rates, but the value to sale as well. So how much they enhance or add on or customize their flight. I think that's an indication of how comfortable they are with interactions. I don't think that's a metric of just being a pushy salesperson. And then, of course, retention. I don't think retention would happen if the experience wasn't good. I don't necessarily like separating them up, to be honest with you. And user experience creation, design, and management and optimization are intertwined. And it's very important for me that they're intertwined. And I think I would think very differently about my role here if I was just producing something into the world and then another team took it and did stuff to it. That would be, I don't think I'd be comfortable with that at all.
I guess that's okay when that makes a lot of sense when you're in an organization like Virgin Atlantic. But there is the danger in some organizations I've encountered where, because they're so focused on conversions, or average order value or you know, some metric like that, that, you know, you end up resorting to, you know, dark patterns and that kind of stuff in order to produce those. So there must already be a culture within the organization that hasn't got a predisposition towards that kind of thing. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of, I don't want to sound high and mighty about it, but I think there is a moral, there is a moral line that runs through this. And if you're willing to do anything whatsoever to get a sale, I don't think any degree of great user experience is going to help you out of that situation. And if you've got execs who are willing to not be open and forthright with their customer base in order to make money, I agree with you in that respect. That's just a bad place.
Because you could imagine, you know, without mentioning any specific airline names, I won't do that. There are airlines that, for example, will add insurance onto your flights without really asking permission for it. They just add it to the basket. Now, from my point of view, that's a terrible user experience because it's highly manipulative. But they do it because that's their culture, you know, especially at the kind of bottom end of the market. So in that kind of situation, they're going to need metrics to shift that culture. You're going to need metrics that are maybe less around conversion rate and average value, and more around, I don't know, time to complete task or customer satisfaction. So there is a need to kind of balance the metrics, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think that in time, all of those organizations that fall into those patterns will ultimately kind of, I'm optimistic. They will pay the price. Yeah. I think they'll ultimately see that what they're doing is short term, and they'll continually be chasing short term. And at some point, somebody will look at it and go, do you know what? The trend for us is just pointing downwards. Mm-hmm. What can we do to actually take some long term effects? Because I don't believe that users are stupid. I believe that even if you in that scenario that you describe, if you have tricked them into insurance, they'll know that. They'll work that out sometimes, and they won't feel good about that. And next time they come back, if they come back at all, they'll be wise to you, and they'll be much more cynical in anything that you say or do with them. So I don't think it gets you anywhere. But don't be mistaken in that Virgin Atlantic is not a commercially focused organization. You know, our commercial team is considerably big, and it's very successful. So there is a continual eye on turning the team into a much more optimization-led and trading-focused team. And so some of the roles that I'm bringing in are specifically around managing optimization and managing tests and moving at a faster pace. So I think they're all connected, and I think they're all intertwined. And I think that it does help that we have a particularly customer-centric culture here, but I think that's still achievable in other organizations. I don't want anyone listening to this, if anyone's listening to me at this point still, to think that these things aren't achievable in every organization, because they are.
No, I would agree, absolutely. You know, you just need to adapt your approaches slightly dependent on the organization that you're in. I could go on forever, but I think we probably need to wrap up. But there is one last question that everyone listening to this is currently desperate for me to ask, which is, how do they apply for a job with your team? Because it sounds frigging amazing, and I want to join it.
Come on board.
So is there a link, or is there an email address, or how do they find out more about your team?
Oh, that's a great question. I wish I'd prepared something for this. That's terribly disorganized. Well,
worry about it. If you're not prepared, don't worry about it, because you can email me something and I'll put it in the show notes. How about that?
So you can look at the Virgin Atlantic careers site, and there's constantly over the course of 2018, there'll be I hope there'll be lots of roles going up there. But you know what the best thing to do is just find me on Twitter and just let's start talking, and send me some work, and I'm happy to hear from anyone. I've got lots of time to talk about user experience and design, and I'll go on for hours. So I'm on Medium, I'm on Twitter, you can find me on there, and just reach out.
So what is your Twitter ID, just to point people in the right direction?
At Martin Redding. Martin with a Y, Redding, no A and one D.
Yeah, that's so straightforward. I'll put all of it in the show notes. It'll all be there. Martin, that was absolutely brilliant. It was so good to have you on and to just talk about what's going on in Virgin Atlantic. I love your attitude towards building a user experience team, and I'm looking forward to hearing about the exciting things you do going forward. That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And if you find yourself down this way, please drop in and say hello.
Oh, absolutely. Well, there you go. That was our interview with Martin.
I really enjoyed listening to that. It took me back, Paul.
Oh, did it?
Yes. Because I used to be signed to Virgin Records when I was back in the day.
Ah, but Virgin Records is not the same as Virgin Atlantic.
It was run by the same bloke, or set up by the same guy. Anyway,
this is true.
And even back in those days, Branson was all about looking after the people, A, that worked for him, B, that bought stuff from him. And I can remember we got, we were invited to a big sort of huge extravaganza party at his mansion in Oxfordshire every year.
Oh, right.
And one year they ran out of food. So he sent out to the Oxford McDonald's and got something like 2,000 burgers delivered. Things like that. It was just, yeah, great. So, you know, I think that having someone who's driving a company from the top with that kind of attitude means that you're kind of already, you're already in the right place.
Yeah. That was the thing that really struck me from talking to him. No disrespect to poor old Martin, but he's got it easy. You know, I'm sure he'd disagree with me strongly over that. But having someone at the top of the organisation that's giving that strong leadership and that strong, you know, customer focus makes such a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's almost like, I mean, all right, maybe digital first isn't maybe something that, you know, they talk about. Well, it probably is, but you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
But just that focus on customers and doing the right thing and running your business in a way that, you know, isn't out to trick people and all that kind of thing.
Mm.
It's just, yeah, it reminded me of what it was like back in the day, hundreds of years ago.
There
was
we go.
One thing he did say, though, that I had to pick up on, that I'm not sure about, because it's this idea about, you mentioned certain airlines that might trick, in air quotes, you into buying insurance and that kind of thing. I'm not sure that they do genuinely put people off. I think people know that that's what's happening. And it's all about, I'll put up with that if it's cheap enough. And it's this kind of balance kind of thing. So
That's a really interesting observation, because I was doing some usability testing with somebody relatively recently. And we were testing some competitor sites. And one of them was Booking.com, which is well known for this kind of manipulative behavior. And the person I was testing with said something along the lines, I can't remember the exact wording, but all of this manipulative stuff just gets on my wick, something chronic. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why do you still use the site? Because it was a site that they'd identified they used. And he said, oh, because it's so easy to use. So he was willing to put up with the crap because of the ease of use. So it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit like, say, like, you know, the cheaper supermarkets like Aldi and Lidl and that kind of thing. And they're not out to trick you, but they there's no frills.
Nothing. No.
But people will put up with the no frills if the price is right kind of thing. So it's a balance kind of thing.
Mm.
But finally, I swore blind that when you said, but the most important question I need to ask you, Martin, is, I thought you were going to say how to get an upgrade on a flight.
Yeah, I should have. That would have been a much better question. Damn. Oh, well, it's too late now, isn't it? So if you want to follow Martin and the stuff that he's doing, you can do so, as he said, at twitter.com/MartinRedding. I'd also encourage you to check out his Medium post about where he's looking to recruit people. It's a bit of a mammoth URL. So what we'll do is we'll put a link in the show notes to that instead. But it is definitely worth checking that out if you fancy a job in UX, because it seems like he's a busy bee at the minute.
I can't think of many places that'd be nicer to work than that.
No, I can't either.
Like, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so there we go. That is pretty much us done, except to mention our second sponsor, and I am so chuffed. It's Balsamic. They're doing another season with us, right? They're back, and I've been doing so much work with these guys recently. It's so much fun. At the moment, I'm working on them with them on a 5-hour masterclass on encouraging conversion in a way that isn't manipulative, going back to what we've just said. That's why I'm so busy at the moment, Marcus. I'm writing that like mad at the moment. I think it's the biggest, the most complicated thing I've ever done, and Balsamic are supporting me doing it, and I'm so excited. But there'll be more on that later. I'll bore you endlessly about that in the future. For now, let's just talk about Balsamic in case you didn't catch last season. You really should check out Balsamic Cloud. It is by far, in my opinion, and that's not just because they're supporting my masterclass, the fastest, easiest, and most collaborative method for wireframing. I honestly believe that. Everything, you know, if you know how to do drag and drop, you can use this. It is so, so straightforward. And that means anybody can use it. You can create a great experience. You know, you can test and prototype a really good experience without having to get out some fancy design tool, which means your manager can do it. Your stakeholders can do it. You can get users doing it, you know. And it's actually even easier than pen and paper because it is just drag and drop. It's great for collaboration as well. And also... for designers, if they want to collaborate in real time with maybe a stakeholder or a customer, it's so much more straightforward than some of the more kind of fancy prototyping tools out there. So it's really good for quickly pulling things together in the room with the client. I would encourage you to give it a go. Basically, you can find out more by going to boag.world/balsamic. And yeah, give it a try.
Cool.
Okay, I think other than your joke, we're done. Let's get the joke out of the way then, I suppose. I don't suppose we can drop the joke because you do the thought for the day now.
It's not up to me, Paul. It's up to the millions of listeners.
Go on, come then, on. Spit it out.
This is from Sean Dones. I think that's how you pronounce his name on the Boag World Slack channel. Thank you. More jokes, please, people. Why did Mr. Potato Head turn down a job offer at the Sports Network?
Go on.
Because he didn't want to be a commentator.
Oh, no. Oh, that is proper dad joke. Well done.
Ooh, I did like that one.
Yeah, no, I like that one as well. I approve. Cool. All right. Well, that's our first episode done. No doubt it's going to be a mammoth one, but who cares? I suppose the people listening do, but we don't, and that's the main thing. So, okay, join us again next week. Let's see who we've got on next week's show, where we've got Andrew Miller. Apparently, he's not called Matt, who is from the University of Dundee, and we'll get to talk to him about creating user experience culture in a higher education institution. Could not be more different than Virgin Atlantic. But until next week, thanks for listening. Bye.